The Sanctuary, a community of Jesus people promoting the glory of God in all things to all nations through gospel-centered missional living. Whether it be working with groups in Africa to build orphanages and help rid the continent of AIDS, or feeding the hungry, giving to the oppressed, and helping the hurting who live in our own community, The Sanctuary invites you to be part of a culture of passionate service. You can change your world. Be inspired. Join the movement.
We all want to be loved, right? We want to be known. We want to be connected. We want to be all together. We want what's good, but it can get a little exhausting, right? If we're just chasing after that. How do I improve myself, make myself better, and invent a new me? But I think the new year really does. It symbolizes change. It symbolizes this time for change. And God is really interested in change as well. But I think it's a little deeper than the word change, right? He's interested in transformation. He's interested in transformation. And I want to know really kind of what's the meaning of that word transform? So I consulted none other than the smartest man in the world, Noah Webster. Can you imagine going to a party with that guy? He knew the definition of everything, apparently. So anyway, here's what he says. He says, to transform is to make a thorough or dramatic change in the form, appearance, or character of. To make a thorough or dramatic change in the form, appearance, or character of. See, if I'm going to change this year for me, then I need to find what's truly good for me. I need to get in and I need to stay in step with God. If that's going to happen. So, you know, I think we all want good, right? For our lives, for our kids, and our families, we want that. But here's what's so awesome. For all our wants, for all our dreams, for all of our desires, our goals, our ambitions, our work, our investments, God's already told us what's good. He's already told us what's good and what he requires. I mean, have you ever wondered, what does God want for my life? What does God want for my life? What is his will for me? Have you ever wondered what God requires? What is it if we could just see God's heart? Well, there's this group of people in the Bible called the Israelites. Joe was already talking about them this morning. And, you know, they had the same question. What does God want from us? What's good? What does he require? And Israel, they were concerned over requirements. They were concerned over the letter of the law. Today, I think, let's just throw all of ourselves under the bus, right? We may fall under a couple of categories. One is, the rule followers, those that want to know, you know, man, I want to know up front, what is it that God requires? Because I'm going to do those, I'm going to do those laws, and I'm going to do everything, and I'm going to obey them implicitly so I can get God's blessing. And then maybe the second category is those of us that catch ourselves chasing easy. The minimum requirement, the shortcut, the easy route. But when we apply either of those to our spiritual life, that's where it breaks down because neither one of them requires a relationship. So it really doesn't work. And that brings us really to the passage that I want us to look at today. As we think about love and justice and we kick this whole thing off here at the sanctuary, let's look at Micah. Micah 6, 1 through 8. This is the Lord's case against Israel. Okay, that's not a good place to start. God's got a case against you? Oh, boy. Right? But here we go. Let's jump in. It says, listen to what the Lord is saying. Stand up and state your case against me. Let the mountains and the hills be called to witness your complaints. And now, O mountains, listen to the Lord's complaint. Uh-oh. This is not off to a good start, right? That can't be good. Listen to the Lord's complaint. He has a case against his people, and he will bring charges against Israel. So here he goes. Oh, my people, what have I done to you? What have I done to make you tired of me? Answer me. For I brought you out of Egypt and I redeemed you from slavery. I sent Moses, Aaron, and Miriam to help you. Don't you remember me? Don't you remember, people, how King Balak of Moab tried to have you cursed? And how Balaam, son of Beor, blessed you instead? And remember your journey from the Acacia Grove to Gilgal, where I, the Lord, did everything I could to teach you about my faithfulness. And then it changes here. And you have Israel's response, and Israel's response is, what can we bring the Lord? What kind of offering should we give him? Should we bow down with God before offerings of yearling calves? Should we offer him thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Should we sacrifice our firstborn children, pay for our sins? No, don't kill your kids. I added that part. It's not really in there. But that's how extreme it was getting. No, O people, the Lord had told you what is good. And this is what he requires of you. All right, we're all ears. To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with the Lord your God. So the Israelites have this question, right? What does God require of us? What does God require of us? What are the laws that we're to follow? What kind of sacrifices are required? What's the list? Because we'll carry it out. What's the list? And the response is simple. The Israelites should have already known the answer to their questions. He's already shown you what's good. He's already shown you what the Lord requires. God says he doesn't need more sacrifice, religious rites. Instead, he sought Israel's justice, mercy, and humility. Did the answer to Israel's sin problem, was it more numerous or more painful sacrifices? Proverbs puts it this way. Proverbs 21:3 says, to do what is right and just is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. So the answer was something much deeper than religious observance. They needed this change of heart. Transformation. See, Micah lived in this time of economic change. There was a lot of prosperity going on. And it was also this time of extreme spiritual decay. So there was this widespread wealth, and it resulted in a society that was just kind of wanting more and becoming more materialistic. They were consumed with the desire to get more and more stuff. And they invested their wealth in these in real estate. And these huge farms started to sprout up. No pun intended. These huge farms. And as a result, the small farmer was kind of getting pushed out, and it was making hard. Old ways of life, of living in community and covenant with God, were being neglected, and social concerns were kind of going by the wayside. They were really low priority for the leaders. So while a number of Jews were enjoying wealth and power and expansive affluence, there was still this large portion of widows and orphans and others that were scarcely making it. And the problem was, because of the spiritual decay, that the wealthy Jews, they weren't taking care of the least of these, even though the law required them to do so. So what Micah makes it really clear here, that God hates unkindness, he hates idolatry, he hates injustice, he hates empty ritual, things that God still hates today. And so God's prophet, it fell on Micah's shoulders to respond and deliver this message that's become very famous. In chapter 6, verse 8, know, O people, the Lord has told you what is good. This is what he requires of you, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Another version puts it this way, see that justice is done. Let mercy be your first concern, and humbly obey God. See, to really, I think, understand, have an understanding of God, it should compel our love for others. Pastor Joe was talking about that earlier. It should compel our love for others and engagement in justice. To do justice is to follow God. I really believe that. To do justice is to follow God. See, when we chase after these good things, right, to make our life complete, but God's already made it plain how to live, what to do, what God is looking for in men and women, but I'm all too afraid that in my life that I focus on everything else but what God has required. These aren't just things to be added to a spiritual resume of religious behavior. It's not a checklist. This is a summary of how God wants us to live. God requires and delights in a faith that produces justice, and it loves kindness and walks humbly with him. It's not a checklist. Justice, God, kindness, working on it. Humility, well, maybe someday. That's not what it is. See, it's really blurry. Justice requires humility, which includes kindness, which looks a lot like humility, as does real justice. But this justice is a different kind of justice because it's paired with walking humbly. And kindness has this different edge to it because it's situated with justice and walking humbly. So I think we have to unpack it and look really closely at those three things. So justice, let's look at that. Justice, it's the action behind the attitude. I think, I used to think that justice was, you know, this flag that kind of weird people on the fringes, you know, it was a flag for them. Or college kids, they're all hopped up on a cause. Justice was for them. But I couldn't be farther from the truth. in that kind of thinking. Justice is part of who God is. So it's for everybody. It's for everybody. And He doesn't want us to just think about justice or wish for justice or want justice. It's clearly not enough. We're told to do it. To do justice. Okay. It's an action. It's not something that we do on occasion, but something that we live out. It's part of the fabric of who we are. I don't have this figured out, by the way. This is what I'm learning. It's part of the fabric of who we are. To do justice means I got to get busy. I've got to get involved. I've got to give a rip to the point that I actually do something. I got to give a rip enough that I move to the point that I do something. I act. I love Ken Weitzma puts it like this. He says, pursuing justice is the call to live and die for bigger things. Beautiful. To pursue justice is the call to live and die for bigger things. Doing justice, what we're talking about here when we talk about justice, what is it? Micah's understanding of justice might be a little bit different than ours. Micah's understanding is more than rules for the smooth order of society or making sure that everything is fair and right. Quite honestly, before I studied the passage, that's really what was my understanding of justice. But Micah's talking about a justice that's personal to God. It's personal to God because it's from God. It's God's justice. It's not something I come up with. So God's justice reveals what's in His heart. It reveals what's in His heart. The heart of God calls us to be a just society where fairness is restored for the most vulnerable. What we're talking about here in this month of January. Where everyone belongs. Where the neediest are taken care of. Where no one goes hungry or is disenfranchised. And where the voiceless are given a voice. See, throughout Scripture, we see that God is the defender of the poor. He's the defender of the poor. He's the defender of the oppressed. And we see it and we know it, but what are we doing about it? Micah says, live in a way that promotes justice. These prophets, man, they were on it. Amos 5:24 says, let justice roll on like a river. Righteousness like a never-ending falling stream. Do I live in a way that lets justice roll on like a river, or do I dam it up and I keep it for myself? Am I letting it roll on? Do I live in that way? Back in the very beginning when Adam and Eve, when they chose to not walk humbly with God, when they chose to do their own thing, in fact, do the opposite of what God had commanded, when all that happened, we lost our relationship with God. And the whole world stopped working right. The whole world stopped working right, and peace was lost. Shalom was broken. Shalom is the coolest Hebrew word. It's such an awesome word. It has all this stuff wrapped into it. Shalom, this isn't the definition of it. All these things are in it. Shalom holds this idea of completeness, safety, soundness, contentment, tranquility, harmony. Shalom, in other words, is the way things ought to be. The way things ought to be. And that's where you and I come in. God has extended this divine invitation. Imagine going to the mail and getting that. A divine invitation. You're invited. You're invited into this deal. You are invited. It's a requirement, really, for those that call us followers of Christ to bring some shalom back into our world. And we all know we could use some shalom right about now. Right? And that's what happens when we do justice. When we do justice, things are restored. And when things are restored, people thrive. It's God's way. It's His way. Tim Keller, he's a pastor in Manhattan. He has this great metaphor that I just love of a tapestry to describe shalom. Tapestry is the woven cloth, right? And there's countless, literally millions of ways where these threads are interlaced so that the fabric is tight. It shows the importance of relationship. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be headed to Uganda. And on the way, we stop in Turkey. And in Turkey, they make these incredible tapestries. Literally, it takes them a year to complete it. I've got this really, there's a short, it's like 60 seconds video. I want you to see this here. tapestry making in Turkey. Now, I haven't sped that up. When I first saw that, I'm like, that's not real. Come on. But you can see people in the background, they're walking at normal speeds. Can you imagine doing that for, like, I don't know, 10 minutes? A year. A year to make this beautiful tapestry, right? Millions of ways where those threads are being interwoven. It's intricate. Man, I mean, the carpal tunnel right there, my fingers already hurt just watching that. But think, have that image in your mind and think about it. If you throw 1,000 threads on a table, no fabric results, duh, right? The threads have to be rightly and intimately related to one another in literally a million ways or more. So each thread goes over and under and through the others in thousands of points. Only then do you get a fabric that's beautiful and strong. It covers, it fits, it holds, it's admirable, it shelters, it delights. That interwovenness is what the Bible calls shalom. Shalom. So in his book, Generous Justice, Keller says, in general, to do justice means to live in a way that promotes a strong community where people can flourish. Right? So specifically, though, to do justice means that we go to those places where the fabric of shalom is broken and people are falling through. Right? Because it's not tight. And we bring shalom. People are falling through the fabric, and we repair it. That's what happens when we concentrate and meet the needs of the poor. That's doing justice. See, when society disintegrates, where there's crime, where there's poverty, where there's family breakdown, there's no shalom. However, when people share resources with each other, when we work together so that shared public services work and schools educate correctly and businesses begin to flourish and all of that starts to happen, then the community is experiencing shalom. When people with advantages invest them in those who have fewer, the community experiences a civic prosperity or social shalom. So what that all means is that when we do justice, we're bringing it. We are bringing shalom. We, us, nothing special, us, in this room, you and me, we can do that. But here's the kicker, to do justice, I've got to show up. I've got to show up. I have got to put myself in those places. And when we do it, when we love it, when we walk it, we are bringing it, and we've seen a glimpse of the kingdom of God on earth right before our very eyes, and we are a part of it, and we're living into who God designed us to actually be. It's beautiful. But the only way to reweave and to strengthen the fabric is by weaving ourselves into it. And it's messy, and it's hard, and it's tedious. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm doing the same thing over and over and over again. Yeah, probably. But wow. We're all like those threads thrown together on a table. When we keep our money, our time, ourselves, and our power, our access, when we keep that all to ourselves, instead of spreading them out into our neighbors' lives, we're literally just on top of each other. We're just on top of each other. But when we are interwoven socially, relationally, financially, emotionally, reweaving shalom means to sacrificially thread and lace ourselves, our time, our goods, our power, our resources into the lives and needs of others. And it becomes a thing of beauty, like a one-of-a-kind tapestry. Yeah. As the leader of Attack Poverty, I am allowed this kind of incredible front row view of transformation. I see the broken helping to heal the broken. I see those who have enough giving to those with nothing. I see those that we would consider the poor on earth rising up to be rich in spirit. And in short, I see God's kingdom working and breathing and growing. And I'm learning that in order to know Jesus as best I can, I have to know those whom Jesus was always around. The poor, the marginalized, the broken, the wandering, the hurt, the hungry. So the first requirement Micah mentions is to act justly. to act justly. But when our lives intersect with people who are different than ours, our deep-seated beliefs come to the surface. And sometimes, whether we like it or not, it's kind of ugly. We're like, oh, I didn't know that was in me. I didn't know I thought that way about those people. I didn't know that. And that's where I think mercy comes into play. I think that's where mercy comes into play. The verse says to love mercy. What's mercy? Mercy is God's unconditional grace and compassion. So in light of the passage, for me to show mercy means I have to find ways to turn compassion into action on behalf of the poor. Loving mercy is all about caring deeply for others, especially those in need, and being a champion for mercy. It's about treating others with kindness and mutual respect, dignity. We're all created in the image of God. To walk alongside those who suffer, showing faithfulness and generosity and compassion. We can't do justice without loving mercy, or at least we shouldn't. I think if we do justice without mercy, it usually comes off really cold and highly arrogant. See, in Micah's second requirement, the Hebrew word from over 2,000 years ago, a little more difficult for scholars to translate. The first word is clearly love. The second word is harder to translate. Whether you land on the word love loyalty, or love goodness, or love mercy, or love kindness, what's important here is Micah urges us toward a significant kind of love, a love that is a way of life. The kind of love that reveals God's commitment, right? His commitment to love. Our God is merciful. Our God sticks with us every step of the way, in every circumstance of life. And that's what's required of us to love mercy. The last thing that Micah says is to humbly walk with God. This is the vital piece, I think, of this whole passage. If I'm not humbly walking with God, how can I sincerely act justly and love mercy? Walking with God changes everything. As you look at 2015, walking with God is transformational. It changes the way I live and the world around me. Why is it that humility is linked to those issues of mercy and justice? I mean, why can't it just be about mercy and justice? Is it possible that the only way to have a heart for those in need is to indeed recognize my own condition in my own need in the sight of God apart from Jesus Christ, to recognize and address my own poverty? Have you ever thought about that? What is the poverty in me that I need to address? I've come to learn that poverty is deeply spiritual. It's about brokenness, broken relationships with God, with one another, with myself, with the world around me. And I just can't humbly walk with God without being mindful of my own poverty. It's really kind of not possible. A biblical view of God will always lead us to humility. I mean, think of it. Who of us could stand before God without the saving grace that Jesus has provided for us through His death and resurrection? Right? So God, without His saving grace, where are we? It appears that we need to reckon with our own ego, with our own pride, with our own self-sufficiency, if we're truly to be useful to God as these distributors of justice and mercy and ultimately shalom. I got to do business with me. Yeah. I just can't walk humbly with God without being mindful of my own poverty. A biblical view of God will always lead us to humility. It's really true. Humility brings us awareness that there is a God, and I am not it. There is a God, and we are not Him. And then living out in light of that fundamental truth, I think that's what it means to humbly walk with God. But how do we do this? How do we do this, you and I? Well, you must first acknowledge our sin. We must first acknowledge our own sin and be willing to submit to God's mercy. It's only through humbling of ourselves that we're allowed to walk with God. 1 Peter makes it really clear, 5:5, he says, God resists the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. God's blessing and His salvation come to those who acknowledge their spiritual bankruptcy. Deeply in debt here. Deeply in debt here. Before God, you have no ability to even begin to pay it off, to redeem yourself. You can't walk with God apart from a relationship with Jesus. I can't imagine a greater way to start any year, let alone 2015, than starting there where you admit, you know what, Jesus, I need you. I'm sick and tired of chasing after the stuff and thinking that I'm good. I'm ready for your good. I'm ready for your good. I understand my poverty, my bankruptcy, my sin. I need a Savior. I'm ready to humbly walk with you, God. And then hold on. Because that's when transformation happens. I believe there is a direct connection between the depth at which the gospel shapes our self-image into the depth at which we're able to identify with those in need. Walking with God's transformational, because the more I walk with God, the more I begin to see life like He does. And when I walk with God, I find peace. And when I find peace, I can bring peace. I can bring shalom. We bring shalom back to our schools, to our marriages, to our neighborhoods, and to those on the fringes. When I walk with God, I change. And as I change, I change the world. That's really what Micah 6:8 is all about. So the hard truth here is, like the Israelites Micah was speaking to here in the passage, the hard truth is if we are not being the hands and feet of Jesus in a broken and hurting world, then we're not being the people God's called us to be. That's the hard truth inside the message here. If a person has grasped the meaning of God's grace in his heart, they will do justice. Grace makes us just. The message of Micah 6:8 says he's already made it really plain how to live, what to do, what God is looking for in men and women. It's simple. Do what is fair and just to your neighbor, and compassionate and loyal in your love. Don't take yourself too seriously, but take God seriously. See, there's people hurting in our community right here, right near where we live. They need to see God's love in action. They are not waiting on God. He's already there. They're waiting on us. So what can you do? Here are some really tangible, practical ways you can jump in and live out Micah 6:8 in 2015. And you're going to hear some great things next weekend as well. So you're really going to have to think about, I have much to think about on the weekend after that. But I would invite you to join an incredible, growing group of churches and volunteers just like you who are breaking the cycle of generational poverty. You can serve with our Friends of North Richmond Initiative. North Richmond, you're asking, it's about 2.8, if you want to get really literal. It's 2.8 miles from where we're sitting. It's on the wrong side of the tracks. There's about 7,300 people. It's been on the wrong side of the tracks for over 100 years. Probably 175, if we're really going to get really accurate. It's a long time, y'all. It's a long time. This community had transitioned from an emancipated slave settlement in the late 1800s to a haven for human trafficking, brothels, saloons, prostitution, and crack drive-throughs up until the year 1996. Now for those older people in the room, that's not that long ago. Like, yeah, 96. Yeah, I remember 96. Right? That was the year the Army Corps of Engineers came in and they bulldozed those saloons and brothels. If you go right up by the railroad track on the other side, you can still see the scars on the ground, the foundations. Some people are actually still holding on, still playing dice games in these, where the saloon used to be. That's my corner. The highest concentration of poverty in Fort Bend County is on the north side of Richmond and Rosenberg together. Here, the annual per capita income is $12,015. That's a mere $345 a year above the poverty line. So people in North Richmond are doing this all year long. They're going above and below the poverty line in the United States. Makes it a little harder about that is within a 3-mile ring of Sugarland Town Center, the median income is $140,000 a year. Keep in mind, in the U.S., the median income is $53,000 a year. So we have this kind of tilted, it ain't real look of what life is like, right? And then you have this poverty. Here in this community, on some days it really does. It appears that generational poverty is winning. 75% of the community does not have a high school diploma. Let that sink in for a second. A high school diploma. 95% of the children are on free and reduced lunch. It's a place, where hope struggles sometimes. North Richmond is a place where I pursue justice, where I pray for peace. I aim to work in a way that generates this community where people can flourish, and many join me in that. And this is the place where all my preconceived ideas about poverty were confronted. I learned that poverty is not about a lack of stuff. Because if it were, I could just show up and I could provide stuff and poverty would be eradicated. It's so much deeper. It's so much deeper. It's spiritual. Poverty is brokenness, really broken relationships with God, with one another, and with the world around us. And this is the place where I came to understand that if poverty is relational brokenness, then I need to take a long look in the mirror and check the relational brokenness and the poverty in me. This neighborhood, what I saw, dramatically affected the way I view poverty. As I am surrounded by the least of these, I begin to understand I am the least of these. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing my own poverty addressed and attacked. It can be tiresome. I'll just be really honest. But it's true. In North Richmond, generational poverty has a stronghold. I really believe it. It's a stronghold. And the cycle of generational poverty, it can't be broken with these kind of small, soft-hearted plans. It has to be directly addressed with great intention through mutual relationship. That's really key. And for us at Attack Poverty, it means we're more about a hand-up than a handout. Our focus is on development over charity, believing that when people are empowered to attack poverty in their life and community, transformation happens. See, generational poverty is really good at telling lies. And that's kind of why you see a strong name called Attack Poverty. That's what we're attacking. We're attacking the lies that poverty tells. Poverty speaks into the lives of its victims, telling them the cycle will never be broken. It speaks into children's hearts and tells them not to dream. Dreams are for the rich, not for you. Poverty speaks into the lives and parents and tells them not to hope. Hope for people with a future. It whispers to the sick, you'll never afford to be healthy. In the pit of the hungry stomach, it growls, you'll never have enough to be full. To the downtrodden, to the forgotten, to the abused and neglected, poverty really proclaims, you don't matter. That's why you're poor. You don't matter. There's a woman recently we employed at our neighborhood resource center. She told me yesterday, she said, Richard, I never knew that God had designed me to work. I never knew that. I never knew that God had a purpose for me. I never knew it. And now I'm living my purpose. Poverty is a stinking liar. And it lies to everybody else in the room, to us, the most wealthy people in the world, and says, whatever you do is not going to be enough. Your arms can never reach around the globe to help those less fortunate. So why bother? Today I'm here to tell you, you can make a profound difference in someone else's life, and you don't even have to leave town. You don't even have to leave town. It starts with a relationship. I believe my life is richer when I develop relationships with people that don't think and smell and look and act like me. I love this how this theologian, Stephen Grable, he uses a gardening analogy, we'll close with this, to illustrate doing justice and loving mercy. I think it might be on the screen. So think about this. I love this. He says, the gardener has this really provocative role. Setting up the various plants and putting them around, uprooting some and putting them in different places so they are positioned to actually flourish themselves. Good gardeners don't make plants grow. They just cultivate the condition where each plant realizes God-given capacity. Rich. gardeners remove barriers to the flourishing and the harmony of natural systems. They try to maintain but not manufacture order. Love that. We get to be a part of that, you guys. We get to be a part of that as a church. Ultimately, at Attack Poverty and all of our friends' initiatives, we're in other places rather than just right here. But we're aiming to be good gardeners, to create a condition where people can actually flourish. So what can you do? At the back of the table, there's a response card. I'll be back there. But let me just kind of share just a quick list of things. I mean, you can swing a hammer, right? You can help us pretty much the first Saturday of every month. We do home repair. You can provide in-school student support at Pink Elementary School over in North Richmond. You can join our prayer team or our street team. You can help students with homework at UCAN Academy, our after-school program. We have two different locations. You can show up at our brand-new Neighborhood Resource Center and help there by teaching adults English as a second language. You can teach GED prep classes. That's our most popular class right now. We kind of actually can't keep up. People saying, I got to get my GED, and that's going to be transformational for me. I realize that. You can be a part of that. You can be a trainer at our Jobs for Life class, or champion adults that are going through this job readiness course. You can teach an introductory computer class in our computer lab. If you can speak Spanish and know computers, come on, because there's a request for that class in Spanish. You can facilitate our faith and finance course that we do. You can lead a small group on Tuesday nights at the North Richmond Street Church that happens. You can help us in the office. You can become an advocate on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, what have you. You can become a monthly donor. You can sign up for the annual Attack Poverty 5K. That's going to be in May this year. College students, you might consider, we have developed a summer internship program that's really awesome. Or maybe you're post-college. That might be something that you consider. You get the point. There's a lot. This is your year. This is your time, 2015.